Welcome to Richer Life Insights. Our goal is to help you drive more money, motivation, and meaning into your life. Today I'm having a conversation with Tim Sanders. Over the next hour, you're going to learn several principles of how to regain lost confidence and do what some of the most successful and happy people do, to live with total confidence. So I've known Tim for several years, and I've seen him in action where everybody's watching him on stage, but I've also seen him when he thought no one else was looking. And I got to tell you, Tim is the real deal. He is an entrepreneur. He's a speaker. He's an author. He's the CEO of Deeper Media, which is an online advice company, which I'm going to talk to him about. He's also written four incredible books. His first one, Love is the Killer App, New York Times bestseller, and his latest, which I'm really excited about, we're going to focus on it today. It's called Today We Are Rich, Harnessing the Power of Total Confidence. Tim, thank you.
Nice to be with you, Robert.
So, all right, Today We Are Rich. People are sitting there listening going, I don't know, I don't feel very rich. So tell us, what do you mean by Today We Are Rich?
Today We Are Rich is a declaration of abundance, if you will. It's a statement about possibilities. And when I was growing up, one of the things I learned, maybe the most important lesson I learned, was that there's two kinds of rich in the world, really. There's bank account rich, and it comes and goes. You really have no control over money. And then there's rich in spirit, rich in meaning. And what that means is that you have enough to go around. And when you believe you have enough to go around, in that moment of sharing, you're worth something. And we've really gotten away from that in the last few years because of the economic climate. We keep thinking that richness is about our bank account balance, the amount of equity that we have in our house, or our financial prospects, when we all know that that stuff just comes and goes. So this book is intended as a reset. Because once you reset your paradigm and you say, I don't have to make money, I have to make meaning, money comes from that, then you'll find a way to actually be successful at the bottom of markets and emerge as a leader during the next top. That's the point of the book.
And so there's a certain psychology when the economy is going down, market's crashing, maybe your friend, your spouse lost their job, it's to sort of tighten up and to not really want to give, which is one of the things you're talking about here. And so how do you get away from that sort of hoard mentality when you don't really feel financially or economically rich?
Well, in India, I've talked to some folks from India that say that one of the spiritual practices is they tell the poor, when they're really worried and they're starting to think and spend a lot of their time talking about, you know, where's the next meal coming from, they say, look, find the last of your scraps, take to the street with the last of your robes, and find the destitute, you know, the ones that are living on the street about to die, and give your stuff to them. Because they found through the practice that when these families miraculously find a meal the next day and replacements, they realize all along it was an illusion. Here's what I tell you. If you feel down on your luck financially, then find somebody else that's worse off than you and find a way to make a difference, whether you're just helping them, whether you're networking them to get a new job, or whether you're giving them a microloan just to have a decent meal for the first time in the last few weeks. That's what my grandmother did all the time, and she learned that when you give until it hurts, it reprograms your mind. Now, you've got to be intelligent about this, but my point is you can't be paranoid enough to fix your financial situation. And as long as you focus on what you lack, you're going to chase everyone out of your life. No one's going to want to give you a job, a loan, or a chance. You've got to get back on top of your game. And you're going to do it through intellectual judo. You're going to do it by taking something that's precious to you and sharing it with someone who needs you right now. And that's a good start. And for a lot of people, I say, why don't you go on Career Builder? Find a couple of good jobs for the 15 people that have been emailing you in the last month that they can't find one, and play matchmaker for good for once.
That's beautiful. I like that. I like that. And so the goal here, the subtitle for the book, is Harnessing the Power of Total Confidence. So what do you mean by total confidence? Why do we need it? And what can it do for us?
Well, total confidence is when you believe that you and your team will be successful in a given situation. So you and your team could be your family, raising the kids. You and your team could be your company, making your numbers, winning market share. It could be your team in athletics. But whatever it is, if you have an outlook that you're going to win, you're going to thrive, you're going to succeed, then you have this total confidence. But it's not just self-confidence. Total confidence is three things. I believe in myself, and I have a strong sense of self-image. I have a lot of potential. I believe in my team. I think they're competent. I think they're properly motivated, and I like them as people. Three, and this is the important one, Robert, I believe in the why behind the what. In other words, I'm doing all of this because there's a higher purpose, bigger than all of us, bigger than me. Mark Cuban used to talk about the idea of the free market, that higher purpose, that if we make love, not war, when it comes to customer service, we will always win in the long run. And then at the time when I was with Cuban in Dallas, people would point down, you know, to Houston where Enron was like rocking it in 1998, and they'd say, what about those guys? Those guys aren't marching to a higher purpose. What about them? They're rich. And Cuban used to always say, man, in the middle of the movie, the bad guy's always winning. And he's nice. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
no,
show
true.
Me a company that violates the higher purpose of the free market that doesn't eventually get its comeuppance.
And so now you've been living these principles for a long time, but you had some years, and you call them the sideways years, where you kind of lost it there, and you didn't have this total confidence. Now the book that you wrote is a very, very personal one. You
yeah.
bring up all kinds of stuff from your past.
Yeah, I
and,
do.
And I found that it was a page-turner because, I felt like I knew you pretty well, but I'm telling you, I learned a lot about you and the struggle. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about what these sideways years, how they started tragically and how you came out of it and how your grandmother helped you so much.
So, you know, my grandmother, Billy, is just a remarkable person. You probably know this. She's still alive. She's 96.
She's amazing. 96. I love it.
96. So she takes me in. This is like, you know, wow, you know, 40 years ago, 44 years ago. I'm dating myself. She takes me in. I'm abandoned as a kid. My real mother wants to be a model actress, runs off to California. So my grandmother takes me in to raise me on the farm. I have a lot of difficulties both in terms of health and in terms of my ability to concentrate. It's the late 60s. They don't know what to do with me. So they put me in special education. I become Short Bus Sanders. That becomes my nickname. And when I was dropped back into the general population in the sixth grade, you can imagine, Robert, I got picked on. I lacked confidence. And Billy was incredibly concerned for me. So she put me on a plan that her dad put her on after the Great Depression. It was the Total Confidence Plan, inspired by the masters. Norman Vincent Peale, Guide to Confident Living. Dale Carnegie, How to Stop Worrying, Start Living. Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, all written in the 30s for the Great Depression generation to get over it. So Billy puts me on the plan, and shoot, man, by the time I'm a senior dude, I am the class president. I'm a state champion debate team member. I've got everything I want, and I won't spoil it for the listeners, but a very bad thing happened to me that very next year. And it was so tragic and so sudden and so shocking, I couldn't believe that this could happen to me, and I just rejected everything that she taught me, like we do sometimes when things go wrong. And I left home, and I went on and did things my way. I followed my passion for music. I never looked back. And for 13 years, I just drifted sideways, both in my career and in my personal life. Fortunately, 7 or 8 years of that 13 years, I had a love of my life, Jacqueline, who I'm still very, very fantastically in love with. We've got a grown kid now. She saw a lot of potential in me. But when I see sideways, here's what I mean. You find a good opportunity. You do a little bit well. You find some way to sabotage it. You go find your next opportunity. It's like every step forward, you find a way to take a step back. There's a lot of people going through that right now. It's very easy to let the recession or a personal tragedy knock you off your game. Then one day in 96, on the way back to Clovis to see Billy, I pass this water tower in Sudan. I take a picture of it. It's the water tower where she picked me up that day when I was turning 5 and took me in. And I realized something, Robert. We all get another chance. If we're willing to admit we were wrong, willing to get back on the plan, and willing to be more thoughtful about our lifestyle, we can recover our point of view that we're going to win. So in 1996, I went back to her and I said, you know, I've just been a turd. I failed. I didn't deal with the situation like you did. I want to be that guy again. Help me. What can I do? And she starts out, she asks me this question. She says, okay, what are you not doing today that you were doing back then when you were on top? And thus began my recovery period. And a year later, I went to work for Mark Cuban at his company AudioNet, which became Broadcast.com. 4 years after that, I'm chief solutions officer at Yahoo in the middle of WWW1. I had caught a rocket, Robert, and the only way I could explain it is I got back on a foolproof plan that has worked since the 30s, and I followed it religiously, and that is what this book is fundamentally about. My story, but more importantly, these seven ideas that I think will absolutely change the reader's life like it has mine and a lot of people I talk to on the lecture circuit and in my practice.
And so when you were in these sideways years, did you know that you were sort of off your game? Did you know that something was wrong, or was it at the end of it?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, you have these little moments where you try to talk yourself into the someday and back in the day conundrum, but you know it when you make eye contact in the mirror brushing your teeth that you're a loser. You know it when you've blown a good opportunity and you're now in the traffic division. That's where you're in your car driving to your next interview. You know when the guy next to you runs right past you in your career and you're just as smart as that guy. You're just as connected. But there's just something more emotionally attractive about him. So you know these things. I can't tell you how many people say, Tim, I'm moving sideways. And they know it because they don't get up every day anxious for the day, and they find themselves blowing simple things in their career or their personal life. So I think a person knows when they're not moving forward. To coin one of Billy's many phrases, success is not a destination. It's a direction, and that direction is forward.
And I think for a lot of people, you can kind of trick yourself for a little while, but you can't trick yourself forever. And so
That's right.
You know when you're stuck. Like you said, you know when you're not on your A game.
That's right.
And what can happen is that if it's just for a little while, you can bounce back. But the longer you're in that rut, man, the harder it is to get out. And what I always tell people, though, is that change doesn't have to take years or decades. I think, and I've seen it, change can be instantaneous. And did you find that once you started working with your grandmother again and she started giving you some ideas, that instantly you started to see the world in a whole new light?
It kind of comes in waves, you know. I learned that paradigm shift kind of happens in a few steps. So, you know, when I went back to her and she really, really pointed me back to those four or five seminal books that were so precious to me, and then I began to read those and then compare them with some of the modern works, say like Covey's Seven Habits and things like that. Within, say, 3 months, step one was I changed my mind diet. So I stopped feeding my head garbage, and I started to invest time every day feeding my mind good stuff.
And this is good. This is principle number one, right?
So this is what I started, and within 3 months, I had become addicted to getting up every morning and loading my head with specialized information that gave me confidence to attack the workday.
As opposed to what? What were you feeding yourself before?
Well, you'd get up with the mutters, so you'd have that self-conversation. This is all pre-internet, so it wasn't, you know, the typical routine of today. But I would get up in the morning, and I'd turn on the news, and I'd complain about having to go to work, and I'd listen to, you know, music on the way in to distract me from the task at hand because life is so miserable, and I'd hang out at the water cooler with the rest of the losers, and we'd talk about gossip or the top sales guy who we think is just lucky. And that was the nature of the game, and that's bad enough because you kind of attract a lot of negative people into your life when you're in that mode. But I got friends now, much more disastrous lifestyle. Let me tell you how they begin. Tell me if this sounds familiar. You wake up, put on the coffee pot, open up your computer, check your email, get caught up in a bunch of garbage, go online, find out the market's crashing, and there's all this catastrophe going on. Then you're doing social media, and at best you're laughing at mean-spirited jokes or Charlie Sheen's latest winning hashtag. Then you turn on CNBC at the gym working out, and they're screaming. Then you get in the car, and you're trying to check text on the way to work. You get to work, it's Chicken Little syndrome. You get off, you come home. You're still on the treadmill checking your email to the minute you go to sleep, and you're totally depressed and you wonder why.
And you wonder why would we be lacking confidence as a result of that? You're right. I mean, feeding your mind the good stuff. So that's principle number one.
Here's the idea too. It goes like this. Vegas has a rule, and the rule is the longer the better stays at the table, the better the odds get for the house, right? It's a basic rule. Well, in media, that's the rule. The longer that you subject yourself to random media or the control of another editor, the more likely you are to become upset, negative, have a pessimistic viewpoint, etc. You should be as judicious about what you put into your mind as what you put into your mouth. When you take back your life and you say, the first half hour to hour I am awake is my time. This is the time I get up, I ignore the world, I load constructive information into my head, I rehearse the coming day. You are feeding your soul a good breakfast, and it gives your mental metabolism a chance to deal with the onslaught of information to come. And that's just the beginning of this process.
And so if you were to design the perfect sort of get-up routine, what would you tell people? What should they do instead of what they've been doing?
Okay. The alarm goes off. Don't hop out of bed yet. You really don't need caffeine. You need gratitude. So the first thing I do every morning is I invest about 5 to 10 minutes, and I like to write it down because it helps me really visualize it, but I invest 5 to 10 minutes, and I recollect two people from the previous day that I'm grateful for. They've done something to help me. They've done something for me, and I don't just think of what they did. I think of why they did. Because, Robert, I'm not grateful about things. I'm grateful for people. Because all the things and all the experience in our life, they come from people, you know, that are in our life. So I wake up with that first waking thought of those two people from the previous day. Then I think about someone from the coming day, like you, that I know is going to be an assist to me in the things that are so important to me in my success path. And that's the beginning thought of my day. Then I put the coffee pot on, and there's always one or two books. So right now, I'm reading Peter Gruber's Tell to Win. You know, it's a big book. It's a great idea. I love storytelling. It makes me better as a speaker. So I load myself about 30 minutes of that in the morning. It's very exciting. Then I take 5 minutes over my last cup of coffee, and I rehearse the coming day, including the hurdles. And I kind of see where the day is going to go. I call it rehearsing my dance moves. Then I take a deep breath, and then I go download my email. And then I deal with other stuff. And then I'm very careful about what I read for the rest of the day. So I don't graze on fast food news at all. I'm very particular about editorial policy at various media publications, whether it's trying to differentiate between USA Today and the New York Times or trying to differentiate between TechCrunch and the Huffington Post or whatever. So even during the day, I'm very careful about these things. And on my social feeds, I got to be honest with you, man. I hide a lot of people in my feed if they don't have anything positive to say.
And so let's take that a step further. I mean, I've written, I've been both praised and almost ridiculed for suggesting this. But I mean, there are two kinds of people in my mind in this world. Those that bring you up, that lift you, that give you inspiration and hope, that sort of have your back. And those that don't, those that are pessimistic and negative and are always telling you that you can't do this and shouldn't do that. And so are you of the mindset that if you have these people in your life, maybe they're family, maybe they're friends, longtime friends, do you get them out of your life? What do you do?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, as Norman Vincent Peale says, you got to get rid of those people with stinking thinking because you will catch it. And so what I've learned is it's kind of like a three strikes policy with close friends and a one strike policy with new friends. But I'm always very clear to people that says, look, my point of view is related to my performance. Today is a judgment call, and I don't like your judgment. I think you're coming from a place of scarcity, and I don't deal with that. I don't have to. And then they keep doing it. And I say, I'm serious, Robert. This is not the kind of conversation that what I have. Talk to me about solutions. Stop talking to me about problems. Third strike, it's like I'm the black hole of information. We're just not going to hang out again. And some people are like, dude, that's not very nice. And my attitude is, I've got a real mission in life, and what good can I be to other people if I lose my own mental stability?
Amen to that. That is so true.
It's just so true. And, you know, the other thing that I've learned is that at work, you had better be super careful about these chicken littles that come to work and say the sky is falling. You know, we live in a world where we want to reward that behavior, like, good dog, I'm glad you bit them, you know? That is not what we need to do. Chicken Little must fry. Because one Chicken Little will spoil your entire project team or your entire group's mood. And when the mood state drops, critical thinking drops, problem-solving ability drops, and this airborne disease called small pie starts to spread. Small pie is when the pie's too small. If Robert gets a slice, the pie just got littler. Mm-hmm. Do you know what small pie does to an organization when it comes to things like knowledge sharing and collaboration? You know what it creates? It creates silos and devil's advocates. You know what a devil's advocate is if he's not a banker or the CFO? He's a really uncreative guy that wants to be a bully. So he asks you when you've got a great idea, is it okay if I play devil's advocate? That's what happens when the airborne disease of Chicken Little hits an organization, and you don't come up with breakthrough solutions playing devil's advocate.
And so how do you balance looking at the world, looking at maybe your new company objectively, looking at the realities that are out there, versus looking at it negatively?
Well, Napoleon Bonaparte once said that the leader's role is to define reality, then give hope. So you've got to find a way to keep it between the ditches with respect to your understanding of what's real and your understanding of what can be. So it gets back again to this idea that you've got to be very selective, very sophisticated about where you get your stuff. Think about choosy shoppers that, and I'm just going to use this example. They say, you know, I go to Whole Foods because I know that the beef is grass-fed, and I know that the vegetables are organic, and I know that the milk doesn't have any chemicals in it. You know those kind of people? I'm that kind of person when it comes to mind food. All right? Yeah. And you can too. You can find out the realistic state of your business climate without getting paranoid. But you're not going to find out turning on Fox News or CNBC and watching the battle of the left and right. You see what I'm saying?
Well, absolutely.
You may very well get to the bottom of it with a couple of wonderful, you know, articles on Harvard Business Review, which has just a fantastic editorial concept, or the Financial Times, which I also find to be very even-handed when it comes to the market.
Well, I think there's a reason that feed your mind the good stuff is principle number one, because if you don't, it's just like feeding your body. It's going to absolutely cloud your perspective. And this one is just so important. I'm a vegan, so I am psychotic about what I put into my mouth. And I've also been very psychotic about what I allow into my mind, into my brain.
Right. And
so you really have to be. So there's a lot that you can get rid of. And in the book, you talk about what you should put in. And so I'm going to save that. Definitely, listeners, you got to check it out, because you talk about a mind diet. You talk about creating a time log with various steps. So there's a lot of good stuff in here about making sure that you give your mind the proper nutrients, as opposed to probably what you've been feeding it.
That's right. And, you know, the other thing to take into account here is that, for those of you listening, that entire chapter, Feed Your Mind Good Stuff, is available from download right now at twar.com. So you can get that entire chapter, and you can take this first step like minutes from now if you want to.
Yeah, great, great. So www.twar.com. So today we are rich, T-W-A-R. So let's talk about principle number two to create this total confidence, and it's move the conversation forward. Now, what do you mean by that?
So the idea here is that the conversation, the words that come into our mouth, the discussion we have at work, cements the mood at work. So we've got to really take more charge out of the conversation that we initiate. We've got to be very selective with our language. We've also got to be very, very aware that it's about the internal conversation, too. So, you know, we're always having this conversation between our conscious mind and our subconscious being, and it's a discussion about what is and what can be. And we've got to be very, very purposeful about it, because the internal conversation becomes the external conversation. That's what James Allen talked about in his book, As a Man Thinketh. So we've got to realize that words have impact. And, you know, I always start out meetings now by focusing on what's going right. Regardless of how tough the meeting situation's going, you cannot start out with what's going wrong.
Which is exactly how most conversations and meetings start, right?
That's right. You know, conversations need to move from problem to solution, from good to great. But frequently, that's not where the conversation moves. Conversations, much like careers, can frequently move sideways.
And you also talk about sort of four ways to frame an event, whether it's in the past or it's happening right now. So there's good, there's neutral, there's get busy, and bad. And
that's
you,
right.
You write that for a lot of us, we make the mistake of framing an event as bad when it really isn't bad. It should be get busy. Can you talk a little bit about what that shift actually can do?
Sure. I mean, you get to make a judgment call on all the data and all the circumstances that come into your life. And the judgment call can either be it's a crisis or it's a challenge. And a challenge and a crisis, they're not the same thing at all, are they? You know, I've learned that there's basically four kinds of news in our life, four kinds of news. There's good news. There's neutral news that's neither good nor bad. There's get busy news. And that is, you're going to have to do something about it. The way things are, you're going to have to change. And then there's fatal news. It's bad stuff that you have absolutely no impact. You can't do anything about it. There's nothing you can do. I find that frequently we do not classify the news correctly, that frequently we look at get busy news as fatal news. And if you think of get busy news, all it means is that now you're going to have to make some adjustments. And if we have that even keel approach to things, it's so much easier for us to have that perception that slowly but surely we're continuing to move forward.
And so in psychology, you're hitting on a lot of principles here, things like learned helplessness and locus of control. So this idea that if something happens, do you think that you have the ability to control it? And if you constantly label things as just being bad, i.e. out of your control, you're not going to do anything about it. But by really focusing and shifting this from bad to get busy, I mean, just listen to that. Get busy. It means action. It means you can do something about it. And so once people start maybe identifying, being a little bit more conscious about how to frame these events, then they can actually start taking some steps to do something about it?
Absolutely. Because, you know, when you are able to step back from a situation and see it's not a crisis, again, it puts you in a chemical flow state where your mind can actually begin to leverage its own capacity, and you can begin to critically think now, and you can calm down enough to attract other people into your life, because no one wants to come to the aid of a super desperate person. But people love to be invited into a very cool challenge. And you can't think of it or talk about it that way unless you've properly coded the situation as merely get busy.
Get busy. I just love that because it makes you feel like, all right, I can do something about it. Makes you feel
That's
like
right.
I can take some action. I can do something to make this better. It's bad. Sure, maybe it is bad. Maybe it's not perfect, but I can do something about it. So that's critical, and you write extensively about it for this principle number two. And also the thing that I think for a lot of us we get sort of caught up in is just worrying about everything. And you offer this simple little formula that you can really sort of crush worry in its tracks. And maybe you can just describe what those three steps are if someone is feeling a little bit worried about something.
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to do if you're worried about something is the first thing you have to do is face the worst case. Because really, you know, what happens is when you're worried, it's a vague use of your imagination. So your imagination has this blurry picture, you know, like Bigfoot. You can't quite see it, but it's ugly. And it's scary and it's enormous, but you won't deal with it. You'd never write down exactly what's going to happen. The first thing you got to do is you got to face the worst case. How bad can this really be? So, for example, in 08, as the market was crashing for housing, I was talking to this mortgage professional, and she's like, I'm going to lose everything. And she was like, you know, sounded like she was going to jump off a bridge. And I said, stop, hold on a second, Connie. Let's talk right now about the worst case. If everything you say is true, what is the worst that's going to happen to you? She says, I'm going to lose the house that I'm living in, and I'm going to have to get a new job. I go, that's it?
Right. She's not jumping off any bridge, is she?
I said, that's it. I said, say goodbye to your house, get your best pantsuit ready for a job interview, and get on with your life. Now, let's make a commitment. Step number two. Make a deal with yourself that you'll beat the worst case. right? So you face the worst case. And step number two is you make a challenge to yourself that by hook or crook, I'm either going to keep this house or I'm going to keep this job or I'm going to beat the worst case. And then step number three is to go find help and be willing to work for it. When you take that approach to a typical worry situation, you find that all the emotion goes out of it and a lot of your fear just subsides.
I think that's true, because when you're worrying, if you haven't really defined it, all of a sudden it becomes this nebulous blob like you're talking about Bigfoot with big hairy, you know, hairy arms and claws and fangs. And you if you really haven't identified it, it's much scarier than if you actually look at it and go, well, actually, that's worst case. And it's not horrible. It's not the end of the world. My family isn't going to starve. And so that can be extremely empowering, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes a big difference, big
huge
difference.
And so principle number three on really how to create total confidence is about exercising your gratitude muscle. And tell me about that. Tell me why should we exercise our gratitude muscle?
Well, because gratitude is a muscle, not a feeling. Robert, if it was a feeling, you'd feel it all the time. I learned growing up that gratitude is one's ability to notice, appreciate, and source the good things that are either coming into our lives, the lives of people we care about. And what happens to us is we lose our gratefulness and resentment floods in. If you don't consciously practice gratitude, like I talked about with morning routines, it is very easy to let everything in life really get you down. So I'll use one example here to illustrate, and I just want to tell you that, of course, because of my magic scheduler here, they've butted me up with everything 45 minutes, so we have about 10 more minutes.
Okay.
One of the things I use as an example of proving this point is I always point to the new hire at work. Think about the new hire, especially today. So the new hire, they get the job. They're just so grateful for the opportunity. They're marching around the cafeteria on the first day of orientation. They're like, coffee's free. I love this. This is incredible. I can't believe they pay me to do this. If they don't exercise and revisit that feeling on a frequent basis proactively, a year later when they're a veteran at the company and some new hire starts and he or she is all gung-ho, they're like, hey, slow down, chill out, you're making us look bad. And that's a classic example of what happens to people all the time in their career. What happens is you live a life of have-tos. I have to go to this conference. I have to go on this sales call. I have to fill out these TPS reports. I have to take my kid to the baseball game on Saturday. But I swear to you, if you got laid off, if you got voted out of that committee, if your children left you, you would have realized all along it was an incredible opportunity. And so I tell people, if you want to improve your performance and your happiness in life, you need to challenge every one of those have-tos, and you need to make them get-tos. One person I know in Seattle with his group, he would take four or five of his leaders into a conference room, and they would take turns firing each other, theoretically. And starting over as a new hire, looking at the company's assets and positions brand new, just like you would if you just started, and the perspective it gave them was so powerful, he told me they were skipping down the hallway to go get back on the phone. So you've got to invest time into noticing, appreciating, and sourcing. And when you do it, the more you do it, two very important things are going to happen in your psyche. Number one, you're going to realize that you're not alone. And that's powerful. The second thing you're going to do is if you express gratitude, and this is important, if you tell people, thank you for what you did for me, more often than not, they're going to communicate to you that they were glad to do it because you deserved it. And it's going to help you have confidence in yourself. So I think the whole process is nothing but goodness when it comes to your point of view, and it's sorely lacking in our culture today. Our culture is like, what have you done for me lately?
Which leads to the next principle, which is giving to be rich. And maybe you can talk just briefly about the remaining four principles of total confidence and
just
give a brief overview. And then obviously, listeners, buy the book, and because you go into so much great detail, so many personal stories. But maybe just a quick overview of the remaining four.
So the idea behind Give to Be Rich is that developing generosity, of course, stems from confidence, but it's also a practice. I mean, giving is like exercise. The more you do it, the more you get out of it, and the better that you get at it. So what I've learned is that we've got to always be people of service, and we've got to find a way to trick our minds by giving what we think we lack, and it teaches us there's enough to go around. We've got to really improve our performance at giving. So giving isn't just about writing the big check. Giving is about empowering other people. Giving is about creating a way through, for example, mentorship or the transfer of intangibles, creating a way for you to actually have more confidence in your team because you're investing in your team. So the more you give, I learned, the more you realize that you have and the more you create in your life. So that's the concept between that one. The other thing I've learned is that generosity is a wonder drug. There's just almost no mental funk or ailment that can withstand a big dose of giving and helping someone else. Stanley Marcus Jr., one of my mentors, once told me, "You will never get dumber by making someone else smarter through mentorship." He said what he learned is that when he felt like he lacked time, if he gave a little bit to the associates and watched them flourish and grow, it would cause him to be more jealous of his time, and he became a better time manager because he learned to prioritize his time because he realized he could really change the world with it. Principle number 5 is called prepare yourself, and basically the idea is that there's a big difference between working hard and full preparation, and that we spend a lot of our life doing busy work and we don't face the really hard stuff that really gives us confidence. And what I'm talking about with that is a few things. First of all, we have to be on a quest for specialized knowledge. We have to spend our life getting smarter each and every day to prepare ourselves for challenges and not just coasting by on sound bites and headlines. We've got to rehearse all of life's important performances as if, including the hurdles, including the scenarios, even if we have to just do it in the mirror. And we also have to prepare ourselves to be successful by storing those success experiences in high definition and loading them into our head right before we hit the stage of life.
And so, yeah, focus on that for a bit, because I thought that was really a powerful insight.
So, you know, you people aren't successful per se. They become successful through a lifetime of success experiences. So the next time that you've got a big pitch and you're really nervous about it, or maybe a big presentation and you're really worried about it, I want you, right before you hit the stage or enter the room to make the pitch, I want you to recollect a time in your past when you rocked it. Similar situation. You didn't know how you were going to do it going in. You did succeed through preparation. I want you to experience that turning point when it all went from scary to really awesome. And I want you to tell yourself now, as you've loaded this in your head, I am just as good today, if not better, than I was then. And that needs to be the last thing you put into your head before you go do the job interview, go make the pitch, go make the presentation. It will fill you with a very grounded sense of confidence.
Because,
and by the way, the next time you're successful, make sure and tell your subconscious that you'd like that to be stored at the front door, please.
You're creating a playlist of your best moments.
That's right, man, the ultimate iTunes playlist.
There
That's
you
right.
go.
Yep.
There you go. Now balance your confidence. Can you have too much confidence?
Absolutely. I mean, you can get out of touch with reality, or you can also become negative emotionally to other people by just getting out of touch. So the whole idea is that you want to be able to find the sweet spot between total confidence and humility. And I've learned that the easiest way to do that is to remember it's not just you. It's all the people that you rely on. It's the higher purpose that you follow. And the best way to balance your confidence is to make sure that you are following a purpose, that there's some worthy why behind the what that's bigger than you. I found that people that follow a purpose are never arrogant. I have found, on the other hand, that people that are childlessly pursuing their passions, which is a very popular argument today, they frequently get arrogant. Because passion wraps you up in self. That's why it's called passion. It's what you like to do. Time just flies. It's not even work to you. You do it for free. But when you devote your life to self, it's really easy for you to get full of what? Yourself. And that's where arrogance comes from. So I think the whole idea here is that by balancing your confidence with a sense of purpose, There is no such thing as too much.
And you offer a really great sort of a worksheet on how to know what your higher purpose is. And so listeners, check it out, the book, where you can actually follow this step-by-step process to really begin to identify what is your higher purpose. And
that's right.
So that's really key. So the last principle, promises kept. Bring it on.
That's right. You know, I always think about it this way. You know, you get a nice car, it's got a beautiful paint job. If it doesn't have a sealer, a year later, it's rusty, right? So integrity is the sealer for your self-image. At the end of the day, all you have is your integrity, your internal sense that you are a person of your word. If you want to generate positive feedback for your entire life with other people, be a promise keeper, not a happy talker. You know, a happy talker makes a bunch of little promises, and if it's hard or conditions change, they forget about it. They keep the big ones, but they miss all the little ones. People don't think very highly of them, and they don't think very highly of themselves. One of the things that Billy taught me growing up is that you've got to obsess about keeping promises, and you've got to keep promises because of who you are. Not because of who they are or because of the conditions that exist. And if you make a promise you shouldn't have made, you should be willing to keep it, even though it's going to hurt, because that will teach you next time not to raise your hand and say, I know a guy.
Which, so you should be really careful about making promises in the first place, because if
That's
you do,
right.
you better keep them.
That's right. And you know, one of the things, and this is like the last piece of advice I'll give, when I'm in a meeting and it's all time to start talking promise world, I've learned to write down every promise that I make, every single one. And I write it down on the back of the page. I fold it vertically, and that's my promise list. And I always schedule a few minutes after a meeting so I can put it together in a note and send it to everybody and get their understanding that that's their expectation and make sure and schedule it so I meet or beat expectations. It's that little piece of documentation that changes our overall performance when it comes to keeping or not keeping promises. And when I did research for my second book, I found out that the number two trust breaker in business is not following up on the little things you said that you do, because those are the little clues people get about whether you respect them and whether you're a person that's organized. So this is a really important thing to finish with, is you can get everything else right in the book, but if you're not accountable, you're not going to believe in yourself 5 years from now.
And the nice thing is that this isn't that hard, especially the small things. We can nail the small things pretty
that's
easily.
Right.
And
that's
like
right.
you're saying, it can make all of the difference. Well, Tim, thank you so much. I mean, this has been fantastic. You're really helping our members create a richer life. So if you want to get more information from Tim, go to the book's website. It's www.twar.com. You can download the first chapter, which is Feed Your Mind the Good Stuff. And let me tell you, it's a good chapter. Focus, start there, buy the book, follow the 7 principles, go back to richerlife.com. I'm going to have a lot more resources and tools that will help you implement what Tim has talked about today. So again, thank you, Tim. Go out, get the book. I loved it. I'm a huge fan, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Robert. You're making the world richer one person at a time, my brother.
Thanks, man.
Talk to you later.
Take care. Good luck.
Thank you.